The following presentation is brought to you by the Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to TV screenwriter and author Bruce Ferber, whose latest novel is Cascade Falls, the story of an Arizona residential real estate titan facing the reality he has deferred for decades. Stick around. And if you're in the market for a new home, try to avoid arid golf course communities that smell like cow shit. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you today by Amazon.com. When you visit MrMedia.com and click on any of the links to purchase books, music, movies, gift certificates, or anything else through our Amazon link, you support this free video podcast. Whenever you need something else from Amazon, please consider returning to MrMedia.com to order it. It doesn't cost you any extra, and we sure appreciate the support. And don't forget, MrMedia.com has more than 1,200 celebrity audio and video interviews archived on the site. That's hundreds upon hundreds of hours free entertainment. Subscribe for free on MrMedia.com, and you'll instantly get an email every time a new interview is posted. You can also watch and subscribe to the show on YouTube, Vimeo, Dailymotion, The Realm Network, and Frequency.com. And if you prefer to just listen, Mr. Media is also available for free on iTunes, Spreaker, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Blueberry, TuneIn, Blog Talk Radio, Podfeed.net, and Player FM. You can subscribe to any of those services and never miss another episode. Finally, you can interact with Mr. Media interviews on all kinds of social media, including Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and more. Friend or follow us, we'll friend or follow you back. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of lion, thieving real estate developers who are long past the point of believing in anything but their own self-serving philosophies of life in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. I'm going to risk offending my guest right at the top of the show because I can't help but think of his latest work, Cascade Falls, as a small novel. Now, in my mind, describing his book thusly is a compliment. I just don't know if he'll see it this way. The thing is, Cascade Falls tells a story about a very narrow strip of life, and it works in ways that more ambitious and ultimately rambling, generation-spanning novels never do. Every character in this book, no matter how big a part he or she plays in moving the story forward, is clearly defined, whether it's Kingpin Ted Johnson, his lost little boy son Danny, or Ted's secretary Barbara. Everyone is here for a reason, and the reason is never to make the reader ache for a shorter book. This is a small book because its tale is told in an economical but elucidating way. Best example of that for me? The few sex scenes are compact, but the action is eye-popping in the telling. Now, none of this surprised me because writer Bruce Ferber comes to fiction from the world of TV sitcom writing, where dialogue is everything and narrative is frowned upon. Ferber's credits include Bosom Buddies, Growing Pains, Sabrina the Teenage Witch, Coach, and Home Improvement. Now, his first book, which I'm now going to have to get, is called Elevating Overman. Bruce Ferber, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you, Bob. Pleasure to be here.
Good to have you. So, offended?
Not offended at all. Not offended at all. I mean, when you say small, you're right. It's not a generation's sweeping novel. It's a slice of life in a part of America that I think a lot of people can relate to. And it's pretty much what I was going for. So hard to be offended by that.
Oh, good. I hate it when my guests hang up on the first 5 minutes. I've actually been, for lack of a better word, collecting TV writers who've turned novelist on the show over the last year or two. Yeah, I think the latest was a guy named Mark Guggenheim, who's the key writer and virtually the showrunner on the CW's Arrow. And his wife is the showrunner on Marvel's Agent Carter, for that matter. And I frankly, I've been finding you guys very easy to read. And to me, that's a good thing. I mean, I have to read a lot of books in this role. And if I start reading and I continue reading and I want to keep reading, that's a good thing versus something that goes on forever.
I have to say that those guys are not from sitcoms. Sitcoms hold a special place in the world, in the literary world, in that they're frowned upon more than anything. Certainly the older style of sitcoms that I worked on. Today you have Transparent and you have all of these sort of literary sitcoms that are being done. But where I came from, if somebody said, oh, now I want to write novels, New York Publishing would say, you're a sitcom writer. You know, what's up with that? We can't take you seriously. But what I will tell you, and this goes for all of the TV writers, that what we learn in our craft is how to keep a story going, keep it involving. You know, it's not just about dialogue. It's about moving the story forward. And, you know, what taught us how to do that? We had to have an act break every, 5 minutes. So you had to create some sort of, narrative suspense. So this, even in sitcom. So in a way, it was a very helpful tool for me, even though, as I mentioned earlier, I was in some ways, I had to work, at least in the beginning of my career, on shows that I didn't particularly want to work on, that some people would consider hacky writing. If you can kind of like know what's hacky writing and know what's better writing, that will keep you honest so that when you finally, get out of there, you'll still have your integrity intact.
Are you saying there were any shows that you may have been in danger of losing your integrity?
Gosh, Bob. Not in danger. I think I'd lost it, and had to reclaim it again. Listen, when you're starting out as a writer and you want to pay your rent, you do what you need to do, And there were very few writers, there's an elite few, but very few who didn't have to work on a couple of turkeys every now and then. And then sometimes you're a very good writer. I know very good writers who have created their own shows, and for whatever reason, they were dismal failures. Could have been the casting, could have been they misread what they thought was going to be good. And it's very hard to make a good television show, as it is to write a good novel.
So I want to talk to you about the book, but now you've got me thinking about other things. Who were you as a writer before your first TV gig? Who did you want to be? What did you want to do?
Before my first TV, I went to NYU Film School, and when I attended there, Marty Scorsese had just – he was teaching there.
Should I know his name? I'm drawing a blank.
He had been teaching there left just as I started as a student. But this was like the beginning of the second golden age of cinema with, you had Friedkin and Bogdanovich, Scorsese. I mean, the film world was just exploding. And there were two really good film schools in the country at that time. It was USC and NYU. And if you were at either one of those, especially if you were at NYU, there was just so much excitement about getting into film and being a writer, director, whatever. And I think all of us wanted to be directors, and many of us knew that you weren't going to just get out of NYU and be offered a feature film. So what I did, I knew I wanted to write, and I had taken some writing classes at NYU, which at that time were the weakest things that NYU offered. It was very interesting. There was one good writing class that I taught. But for the most part, in those days, if you were a film student, all of the emphasis was on how to work the equipment. It wasn't like today where, yes, it's a skill to learn lighting, but you can shoot a feature film with your phone and edit it on a laptop. And that's why there's too many films out there. So I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be a director. I got out of NYU and I made my money. I paid my rent by being an assistant film editor. And what I would do writing-wise is I would take a job for 6 months in the editing room. And then when the show was over, I'd get unemployment insurance. And I looked at that as my National Endowment writing grant. So for six months, For 6 months, I wrote scripts.
God.
And then when the unemployment insurance ran out, you know, I'd submit my scripts and then I'd go back to work. And I had this whole thing going on till finally I sold a spec sitcom script because I had friends who were working in television. Most of my friends were not working on the feature side in writing. So that's how I got in. I got in the door by writing a spec script. Well, I wrote a spec script for MASH, but then I got hired to do two freelance scripts for Bosom Buddies, which was Tom Hanks's first show.
Another name. It sort of rings a bell. Can't quite place it.
I don't know. It'll come back to you.
What years were you at NYU, by the way?
I graduated in 74.
Okay. And anyone among your classmates that we would know?
Oh, yeah. I'm very much. Amy Heckerling, who directed Clueless, she was in my class. And a year before her was a guy named Marty Brest, who did Scent of a Woman and Beverly Hills Cop.
Hoo-ah!
Yeah. And yeah. And who else?
That was Scent of a Woman for people who don't watch enough movies. It was not Beverly Hills Cop, which was Eddie Murphy. I know the difference.
Yes, but when you popped in with the comment, it sounded like it should have been Beverly Hills Cop.
Yes, I didn't get it. I didn't get it off fast enough. So. It's always been a problem.
yeah. So and countless others that I will probably think of later on in the interview. But so that's how I started. And that's how I wound up getting into television.
So were you always interested in being a writer versus being a director or a producer?
Well, I kind of wanted to be a director because, you know, in those days, the director was sort of the auteur, you know, in – that was sort of the beginning of the American auteur, the whole phenomenon, you know, with – it had been – alive in Europe for a long time, but with people like Scorsese and Bogdanovich, and you know, you kind of wanted to have that sort of vision, be able to realize your vision that way. But I always wanted to write, and I always loved editing as well. But when I got out to California and started working on these different shows, editing was a very much a different thing in California than it was in New York, because in New York there weren't that many films and TV shows being made at the time, and being an editor was like a really special job because you were helping the director shape the movie. And then I came out to LA and there was so much work being done, and the editor was almost treated like a pair of scissors for the director, you know. And at that point I started to think, I really got to work on this writing thing because it will get me closer to getting the creative stuff that I want to do, to getting that fulfilled. That's how I went that way.
So how many produced TV scripts do you have to your credit, do you think?
Oh, my God. It's got to be like at least 50 or 60 or, you know, I don't know, many years of them.
Wow. That's amazing. So I mentioned, were there any shows that I failed to mention that do you want to get out there, or do you want to stick to those?
Well, Home Improvement was the most significant credit of mine because I was the showrunner for the last 3 years. Hmm. And before that, I worked on Coach for 1 year, and that was an interesting show to work on. I worked on a show that was kind of ahead of its time. It was one of the first shows on the Fox network. It was called Duet. And Duet was sort of like a prequel.
I remember that show. That was fun. It was odd. It was very odd, but it was fun.
It was odd. It would not be considered odd today because of, you know, Mad About You came after that, and Mad About You was sort of the same concept. But yeah, that was a really kind of fun thing for me to do, and, you know, we did a couple of years of that.
I got to ask, Duet was a show that it seemed like correct me if I'm wrong because it's been a while. Duet seemed like it changed almost from season to season. It was like the premise changed a little, right? It wasn't.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those shows where like you grew up the baby by 3 years in the second. It was one of those shows. And then the network wanted to change it completely. They wanted to make the supporting couple, they wanted to make them the main couple. So I mean, this was never been done before. So we did that in like the last season, and they actually changed the name of the show to open house.
Right.
It was crazy.
What was the name of the couple that starred the first couple seasons?
Mary Page Keller and Matthew Lawrence, Ben and Laura were their characters' names.
Right.
And then the couple who were their friends were Allison LaPlaca, who was very, very funny.
Yeah.
And Chris Lemon, Jack Lemon's son, was her husband.
And so they got moved up in the last season. I remember Allison LaPlaca very well.
Yeah, she was considered to be a breakout star at the time. Yeah. And, she really was very funny, but ultimately when they tried to switch the whole thing around, it didn't get enough ratings to justify it continuing.
Oh, the good old Fox days of Werewolf and, what was it, Mr. President, Madam President? Wasn't there a George C. Scott show?
Mr. President, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they did some interesting stuff back then. Anyway.
Yeah.
I could talk to you about the sitcoms forever, but I want to talk to you about your novel.
Right.
That's what we're here for. That's what we want. We want to sell some copies of this book. I really enjoyed your vivisection, if you will, of real estate development based on my own years of covering real developers here in Florida. Those guys have massive egos. They know no bounds. The thing about them is they're never dull, are they?
Not dull. I mean, well, any of these big time successful entrepreneurs, especially the guys, from the West and the South, these, good old boy, larger than life characters, whether they're in real estate or any other kind of business, if they have a certain amount of success, they speak to large groups of people, large groups of people admire them for their accomplishments. And that's who my character, Ted Johnson, is. And in fact, the guy that he's sort of based on, or, not that I knew the guy that he was based on, but the whole model for him, he actually had a biography commissioned.
I wondered. Okay.
And that's how I got the idea. I got that, and then it was so funny because I found out about this book and I went crazy trying to find a copy. It was obviously self-published, and I went to try and find one, and I thought I located one on eBay, and then it was unavailable, and I was going crazy trying to get my hands on this book. And then I realized, okay, I don't actually need to have the book because I have the concept. And that's when I came up with the idea of having a Hunter Thompson-like biographer, be down on his luck, have spent his money on booze and drugs and women, and be forced to take a job writing the biography of a real estate developer.
I when I got to the Harley Mason, and that's the character we're talking about, when I got to him, I had a little twinge of concern because I've been Harley Mason. I do some of that work. Some of it I get hired by both the major publishers and also privately to do private – books of just that sort, and I thought, oh God, I hope this guy gets redeemed somehow. I haven't had the benefit of the women, the booze, and
right.
all that. I've just had collected the checks, so that was very interesting. But so you didn't actually know a developer like this that you based this on? You knew of him?
I knew of him, and I did as much research on him as I possibly could. And I watched as his communities, sprung up and just like covered the Phoenix area. And I listened to the way my in-laws who live in that area and their neighbors talk about this guy like, he was some sort of god. And because, he had created these communities in the middle of nowhere out of nothing. And suddenly all these people had this whole new life that this guy was responsible for, building. So to me, that was enough to kind of – and I've known enough of these kind of entrepreneur, good old boys type of guys to be able to write this character.
Did your in-laws community, does it smell as described in the book? And
it did. It actually did, because when they first built the place, there were enough dairy farms close by that around 5 o'clock in the evening, the smell would just come wafting over. And, to this brand new community with everything is sparkling new and everybody's smiling that they're living in brand new houses. And then It's like, what about the smell, guys? What's going on there? And then what happened, as the developer continued to buy up the dairy farms, the smell goes away. The cows go away, the smell goes away.
Are your in-laws still around?
They're there, yeah.
Have they read the book?
I think they have. We haven't spoken since. I wrote in the dedication that I hope they were still speaking to me after they read the book. And I really do hope so. I'm going to probably speak to them this weekend.
It would be interesting. Be curious to know how that goes. Yeah, I mean, Florida, like Arizona, and Texas too, I guess, has a lot of these guys who, you know, just they see a cow pasture and they go, ooh, I could get 80 homes in there.
Right.
Golf course
right.
over there. And, you know, but you know, I need the city and the county to build me a road to nowhere first
right.
and have a little faith. Why wouldn't you have faith in a guy like me? Look at me. I'm a success.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But as you know from reading the book, that really all of this is kind of a metaphor. It's a setting for these characters' story to unfold. And what's kind of cool about it is that what Cascade Falls represents is like it represents the American dream for some people. And for other people, it means giving up their dreams to have to move to Cascade Falls. And for the developer, it means his dream is kind of going down the tubes, you know, whenever the real estate market tanks. So it was just a good setting for a lot of interesting relationships to intersect.
For some people, the idea of living in a Ted Johnson-type community would be equivalent to having to have a job at Applebee's, for example.
Yeah, yeah. And for other people, it's what it's great for. I mean, for my in-laws living there, it's fantastic because they lived in Binghamton, New York, where it was gray and or raining or snowing 9 months out of the year. And to them, they'll trade the heat for the snow. I mean, to me, I loved where they lived in Binghamton. I mean, I thought it was like a really nice sort of community. But as we know, that whole Rust Belt is dying for many, you know, there's no jobs there. So to them, you know, you move to a sunny place with warm weather year-round, it's fantastic for them.
I mentioned in the introduction that the couple of sex scenes that are in the book, that they're very succinct in nature, but they're very powerful. Were these the scenes that you were holding out from Sabrina the Teenage Witch?
Yes, the scenes I submitted to the network to do on Sabrina that they turned down. Yeah,
I mean,
you don't get to write that kind of stuff, obviously, when you're writing network television, for sure. But so it was interesting to kind of
Tim and Patricia were pretty hot at times, and
what's that?
Tim and Patricia were pretty hot at times, and
yeah, but it was never quite like that.
Sorry. Well, do you is that one of the things about writing fiction, that not necessarily just the sex, but I mean that you find kind of freeing, that you can actually, you know, write about all aspects of life? You're not just putting fig leaves over certain portions.
No, absolutely. And listen, you know, if I had been coming up in television when all this Amazon stuff exploded and all these cable shows, you know, those are, you know, in a way, they're like novels in that the creators are getting to write their vision. For me, writing novels, it's like I get to do my own TV show and nobody gives me notes, you know, that I could to write my vision. And, you know, the difference, obviously, between prose and television writing is that you get to use language, you get to do internal thoughts without having to do voiceover, and it's a pleasure of its own. I mean, it's obviously hard work, they're all hard work, but writing the novel and not having to go into casting and argue with people who's the best actor for the part, you just write the part, and that's it's a great thing to be able to do.
Tell me a bit about the actual writing, and I guess, you know, maybe go back even to Elevating Overman, your first novel. How was it hard to get started? Was it hard to know if you were doing it right? I mean, did you take classes? What, you know, how do you transition? Because it is two very different types of writing.
I didn't know what I was doing, Bob. I mean, what happened was, I think it was my therapist asked me if I ever thought of writing a novel. And I said, well, I don't know. Maybe I thought of it, but, you know, I didn't take it seriously because, you know, I'm a sitcom guy. And then one day I had this idea for a character and I just started writing the character. I wrote three pages of the character. And this was the Overman character, who was a middle-aged guy who was a loser who wanted to change his life around. And I wrote this character, and it was really fun. It was really fun to write. And then the whole premise of the book was a guy who wanted to change his life. And then one day I went to my mailbox, and I took I had gotten a copy of the Penny Saver that said life-changing LASIK surgery, $299 an eye. And I just said, wow, I'm going to use this. And it became the whole springboard for the story, that this guy who wants to change his life gets LASIK surgery, and not only does he see better, but he starts seeing the world differently. And that was just the beginning of the whole thing. And I let this character kind of follow me and write the book. And I just kept going. I didn't know if I could do it. I didn't know if it was going to be good. And I just did it.
I'm just reminded of another guy who's been on the show who's got TV connections. Do you know Bill? Do you know who Bill Schaft is?
Very well. I had dinner with him one night. His latest book was published by my publisher, and he came out to L.A. and they had a dinner for him, and I was invited. And I'm told that he and I may do a little bit of touring together, or we may be asked to do. I don't know whether we'll do it, but.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah, I could see you guys like out, you know, giving talks and stuff. Yeah, because his last one was somewhat similar to what you're describing for Overman, the character, and again, as I said up front, what I like is the guys with the TV experience. There's a succinctness to the writing. It's compelling. You turn the page. Maybe it's because of the dialogue. It's because of the narrator,
right.
Whatever it is, it works very well. And you guys have obviously spent a lot of time inside your own heads, clearly.
Yeah. Too much time.
Maybe. So where are you now geographically?
I'm in Los Angeles.
Oh, you are? Okay. So how is writing, the actual act of writing, different for fiction than for TV? I gather you've probably spent a lot of time in writer's rooms doing sitcoms, and this is a more lonely pursuit, I'm guessing.
Yeah, and I always say sometimes I get really sick of the company in this one.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's great because you get to write whatever you want to write, but it is very solitary. And, you know, I mean, at least when you're writing for sitcoms, when you go off and write your script, then you go and give it to the group and everybody has their notes and criticisms or whatever. But there is a feeling of, you know, getting some kind of feedback. With this, you know, generally you're not presenting it to an editor till, you know, later on in the process. And occasionally you'll give it to friends or do some readings or something like that. But it is the biggest thing to learn, I think, if you're doing pretty much novels exclusively, is how to get yourself out and how to productively engage with other people, because you're not working alongside them, but you want to know people who are kind of doing things that you're doing. I mean, I read a novel by somebody who it turned out came from TV and movies recently, and I really liked it. And he and I, even though we just met each other like 6 months ago, we become really good friends because we experience a lot of this stuff together. And it's somebody for me to talk to. I can give him something I've written. He can give me something he's written. And it's really worthwhile. So I'm still discovering this whole thing.
I just had a thought. I mentioned Mark Guggenheim earlier, who is a writer for Arrow. His book, his first novel was called Overwatch. Yours, of course, Elevating Overman. Maybe you guys could get together and do, you know, Elevating Overwatchman.
There you go.
I don't know where I get this stuff. I'm sorry. distracting. are your TV days, are they? Do you consider them behind you, or are you still?
I think they are. I mean, you know, it's if somebody called me, it was funny. After I'd written Overman, I wrote the first 150 pages of Cascade Falls, and I got a call to go consult on a TV show 2 days a week, and I didn't care what it was, and how do I get in the car and just get out of here and go do it and see other people? And it turned out it was actually a funny show, and it was great being in a room with creative people again. Those jobs are not, you know, there are not a lot of those anymore where they let you come in as the old seasoned guy and work 2 days a week because they can get some young kid for 5 days a week for less money. And then for me to just sort of start up again and like, it, for instance, Cascade Falls would make a great Amazon series. You could go into this world and do some really good stuff with it. For me to get myself, you know, excited about going in and pitching this thing, and get people excited about me who, you know, I haven't worked in TV and I've never worked in that kind of TV. You know, another thing about Los Angeles and Hollywood is that I am pigeonholed as like the home improvement type guy. So for me to say now, no, I'm really the Amazon series kind of guy because, you know, read this book. And they go, yeah, well, you know, we like the book and everything, but have you ever done like a cable series before? And the answer is no. So, I mean, for me to get the energy, I would probably have to pair myself up with somebody who has done this before. And it's like, you know, if I don't need to do all that stuff, do I really want to do it? And, you know, I don't know the answer to that. If the right thing came along, sure, I'd do it. How willing am I to just kill myself to get myself in the door so they could say, no, thank you? I mean, that's not something I really want to be doing at this point.
I understand. Well, let me ask you this before we let you go. I'm guessing you're in your office, your work
yes.
area. Anything, I didn't prepare you for this, so anything at your desk, any souvenirs of your TV time or anything else you might want to show folks that, you know, hey, we're in your office. You have this rare opportunity to have some company for a minute. Anything?
Okay, I'm going to have to stand up and come back.
Okay, we can wait. That's
but
fine.
I have kind of a funny, just off the top of my head, funny thing to show. Hold on 1 second.
All right. See, folks, there is depth to our picture. you can see he's actually in a room. It's not a green screen.
Okay. So back, this is like something that no one ever got to see on television. Back when I did Home Improvement, if you remember the show, there was a show within the show called Tool Time. Mm-hmm. And on Tool Time
– Pam Anderson.
Yeah. Well, when I got there, it was already Debbie Dunning.
Even better.
So what they would do is they do a segment of Home Improvement, and there was one on drywalling. And, you know, they'd always make stupid jokes about whatever it was they were doing before they actually showed you how to drywall. So we had this thing where Tim talks about all these different types of drywall, and then he mentions something called the wailing drywall. Can you see this?
Yeah.
Okay, this was the network wouldn't let us do this.
Oh my God, that's great.
Shows three Orthodox Jews in front of drywall. But I made sure that I would keep that forever.
Oh, that's great. See, and here I thought maybe you were gonna hold up a piece of Wilson's fence, you know, where I have
all that too.
You do, so okay. So there you
where,
go.
Where I have it, I don't know. But this is good because it never made the air, but it is very funny, at least to me.
No, I think that's great. It's funny, as you were showing us that, I was reminded, I wish I could think what year it was, 93. Okay, so I think it was the 93 or 94 Super Bowl. I had a book out called Why Men Watch Football, and the publisher sent me to do some promo, and one of the places was Radio Row at the Super Bowl in Atlanta that year. And as my wife and I were going through the airport, we suddenly realized that Tim Allen was in front of us.
Right.
And I said to my wife, I think that's Tim Allen. And she goes, "Oh, Tim Allen, he's terrible." And I said, "Shh." And he turned around and looked at her, and I was like, "Oh my God, I just wanted to die." I just wanted to die. Anyway, that's my Tim Allen story. Sorry, Tim. I always liked you. Well, listen, folks. You can find both of Bruce Ferber's novels, Cascade Falls and his first book, Elevating Overman, which I'm going to go find now, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order them right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. If you're watching the show on MrMedia.com, and you have choices, you could be watching it anywhere, iTunes, Vimeo, but if you're watching it on MrMedia.com, either to the left or to the right, underneath Bruce, you'll see copies of both books. You can click on them right now. You can get them as ebooks, get them downloaded to you immediately, or as print books. Now, with Amazon, you know, they have these drones, I hear, so you can get the book delivered to you in 30 minutes or less. Well, you work that out with them. But, you know, you can have the book instantly. And I got to tell you, especially if you know anything about real estate, maybe you've bought a new home in one of these communities, maybe you're a developer, maybe you've worked for one of these guys, or you just like something that's a little, you know, a little comedic, a little, you know, takes a look at life, I think you'll really enjoy Cascade Falls. So, and Bruce, if people want to find you, you've got a website. Is it bruceferber.net?
Yes, bruceferber.net, correct.
And Ferber, as people can see underneath at the bottom of the screen, it's F-E-R-B-E-R. So bruceferber.net. Are you on Twitter or Facebook?
Yes, I'm on both Facebook and Twitter. They can just look me up by name. The Twitter handle is a little odd. It's at Bruce, like Springsteen, B-R-U-U-U-C-E-F.
Why didn't you just put at Bruce like Springsteen?
I should have.
In retrospect, that would have been great.
Yeah. I mean, when I decided to do this Twitter handle, I didn't know what I was doing with Twitter. So
now I want to go in and I want to create a Twitter handle that's Bruce like Springsteen. All right.
Do it. I'd also like to point out that sure. For people who want or are interested in Elevating Overman, there's also an audiobook on Audible that Jason Alexander did the audio for that is really funny.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. All right. Well, Bruce, a lot of fun having you here. I have a feeling there's a lot more stories we can mine. So go write another book. Give me an excuse to have you back, and then we can talk more TV and books. And thanks so much for joining us in Mr. Media today.
Thank you, Bob. It really was a pleasure. And thank you for reading my book. It's amazing how many interviewers don't read the book.
Oh, it's just ridiculous. I mean, why do this if you're not going to be engaged?
Hi, this is Buzz Burbank in the Buzz Burbank Newsroom preparing for you another Buzz Burbank News and Comment. Do you like good stories? Boy, I sure do. I turn over a lot of stones each day to make sure I don't miss the best ones. Sure, some make me angry and some make me sad and some make me laugh, and isn't that what makes us human? I'm proud of the fact that I pack more news into my 10 or 15 minutes a day than the evening news does in a half hour. It's a free podcast at buzzburbank.com, or you can subscribe free at iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or get it on any RSS device. It's like a newspaper for your head. It's Buzz Burbank News and Comment, another Realm Network presentation. Day mornings right here on the Realm Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, welcome to the George and Tony Entertainment Show. Prepare for awesome mediocrity.
We're the Cousin Oliver of the Realm Network. I'm George.
And I'm Tony.
And we're a weekly family-friendly podcast about pop culture.
From our point of view.
At RealmNetwork.com. The George and Tony Entertainment Show from the Realm Network.
This is Snake. Do you read me, Otacon?
Loud and clear, Snake.
Did you listen to the latest episode of the Gaming Marathon on the Realm Network?
Of course. They really know their stuff about gaming, especially that Usid guy.
Yeah, but that Chirac guy is a real jerk. I don't like him.
Regardless, their reviews are spot on and they tell it like it is.
That's for sure.
What happened, Snake? Were you spotted?
Nah, it's just Lowell Meltzer crying about the O's again.
Whew. Close call.
I better continue the search for Metal Gear, but keep listening to the Gaming Marathon each week.
You got it, Snake.
New every Monday afternoon right here on the Realm Network.
It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Hi, this is Mark.
And this is Lowell. And if you're fans of Don and Mike, you may know who we are.
Our number one interns. You've met them on the show. They're the guys that ate all the junk and they were outside with each other holding hands with a sign that said that they loved each other wearing the dunce caps.
And what you may not know is that we started out as fans back in their WAVA days.
Hi, Don and Mike. It's Mark and Lowell.
These are two guys that we once actually called them our proteges, didn't we?
And now we have our own show, so we want you to give it a shot. Just check us out at the Realm Network, realmnetwork.com, or you can go to markandlowell.com.
Resistance is futile. It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Every Tuesday and Thursday evenings right here on the Realm Network. And catch the Poor Premium Show Friday nights.